All right, everyone. Thanks for joining. We're going to get started here. So it's a pleasure to have Nina Liu from Shanghai Jiao Tong University. And she's going to be talking to us about some quantum learning, and particularly in the context of the quantum internet. Please take it away.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for inviting me. It's really a great pleasure to be here, and good morning. So this morning I'd like to share with you some work in an area called adversarial quantum learning. And from the title, you can already guess that it's something at the interface between security questions and learning problems with quantum resources. And this is really motivated by asking, what happens if we start deploying machine learning algorithms, which can be aided by quantum resources in an internet setting? And in such a setting, they would be subject to security violations. And because this is a bit interdisciplinary, what I try and do, I try to assume no knowledge at all on the classical side of things, either machine learning or adversarial machine learning, because I assume most of you guys coming from the quantum side of things. And I'm just trying to introduce first of all the very basic notions necessary to understand some of the developments in this area, and in particular in the second part of the talk to introduce two new works. Where we try to take the first steps in addressing some key questions. What are the general vulnerabilities of machine learning algorithms that uses quantum devices? So vulnerabilities to adversarial attacks, and if there are more general methods of protecting these algorithms. And again, like Chris said, please, because I actually can't see you, so I don't know if you have any questions, whatever, please just unmute and just interrupt me at any point if anything's unclear. Okay, so what are the motivations for these questions? Well, I got started thinking about these because I'm very interested to know what are the things we can do on a future quantum internet. So, what is a future quantum internet? So think about the classical internet as classical devices connected to each other with classical communication channels. And a quantum internet are just quantum devices, so either quantum computers or less universal devices connected by quantum communication channels. And of course, there's so many possibilities of questions you can ask in this setting. And I think, Simon Devitt, who already talked about some of these things a little while ago in the seminar series. But for us, our question is, there are so many possibilities, so how can we start narrowing things down? Well, the first way of narrowing things down is one notices there's really a great deal that a network setting has in common with machine learning. So the first aspect is security. So as soon as you have more than one party, you're going to have security issues in a network setting. And machine learning algorithms has been used for security purposes. So think about spam filters or fraud detection. And also there are security vulnerabilities of machine learning algorithms themselves. So that's actually an area all encompassed under the area of adversarial machine learning. This is something I'll go on a little bit later on. And secondly, they're both naturally distributed problems. So for the internet setting, that's quite obvious. But in real life deployment of machine learning algorithms, the data that you're usually working with, they often can come from different geographical regions. Okay, so think about the data that you might collect from sensor networks or maybe different hospitals that the data you want to collect and you perform your machine learning algorithms on. And thirdly, the motivation for network settings in distributed computing, is really dealing with big data. Why is it that we even want network settings if our centralized computer cannot deal with so much data? And some of the key motivations for machine learning using quantum algorithms, has been to deal with a lot of this big data. Not all proposals, but many of them are. So here, there are really lots of things to explore at this interface, but for this morning, we'll focus on the security aspect of these questions. And actually, this is an interesting question for UTS, like as well. So Peter Rudy, Simon Devitt, me, and a few other collaborators. So we're gonna, put a book about the quantum internet. We'll actually be discussing some of these key questions, right? So including this adversarial quantum learning. So what is this area of adversarial quantum learning? Well, it's right at this junction between these questions about security, quantum information, and machine learning. But why do we expect this area to be fruitful? Well, if you look at the connections between the different components of this Venn diagram, we see okay that there is a very traditionally fruitful connection between quantum information security. So that, you know, the first viable quantum technologies were actually developed in quantum cryptography. And there are also, you know, other protocols, you know, secure daylight quantum computing, secret sharing, anonymous broadcasting, and a whole host of other security protocols. And then this, you know, relatively new area, you know, that emerges between quantum information and machine learning. So many recent developments, you know, either, you know, use machine learning for quantum problems, or try to solve classical learning problems using quantum devices. So, you know, like quantum enhanced machine learning. And, you know, collectively, these problems are called quantum machine learning. And thirdly, there's really a very large overlap between security and machine learning problems. It's an extremely vibrant field that focuses either on using machine learning to enhance security, or something that's becoming much more popular recently, are looking at security vulnerabilities and machine learning algorithms themselves. So we come up with problems like adversarial examples. And this is something we'll look more closely into for the rest of this morning. And for all these problems, they're all under this umbrella term of adversarial machine learning. And so adversarial quantum learning is, you know, any problem that we say, you know, kind of lies in the center of this diagram. And we can really consider the adversarial case as a worst case noisy scenario. So, you know, it may not be in a security setting, but so long as you're in a scenario where you have no access to any of your noise models, the adversarial bands that you have, it will really provide you the worst case band. So you can also think about it that way. Well, again, you know, we see, well, there are really a lot of possibilities for questions in the center of this diagram. So where do we start? So one big motivation I had when I was thinking about this is noticing how many quantum algorithms and also many quantum algorithms for machine learning, they rely quite heavily on having speedups as motivation. But, you know, after being in the computer science department for a while and sort of asking around, you know, there are a lot of classical machine learning people who are not that particularly interested, actually, in speeding up the computation. Well, it's not really their main bottleneck. And they have other concerns, and in particular, concerns with security. And then the natural question for a quantum person is to ask, you know, is it possible for quantum resources to help with security advantages in machine learning algorithms aided by quantum resources? You know, and, you know, in the same way that, you know, quantum resources has, you know, helped in the area of cryptography. And this, you know, general motivation then leads to two other questions. So naturally, it leads to, you know, you asking how vulnerable are machine learning algorithms, right, first of all, to adversaries. So we know, to what extent we need to protect these algorithms. And secondly, you know, once we know its general vulnerability, you know, what are the general methods we can do to make them more robust against adversaries? And we'll show later how we can actually use noise or exploit noise to help in this case. And this will be the main content of what we'll be talking about. But before we go on into these questions, adversarial quantum learning, well, what is classical adversarial machine learning? Right, and before that, I mean, I assume no knowledge about any of this classical stuff. So I'll try and begin at the beginning. What is machine learning, firstly? So machine learning is a basic response to the question of how computers can learn without being explicitly programmed. And there are two main classes of problems that it can solve. So there are classification problems. So, you know, given a particular example, you want your computer to output for you a label for this example selected from just some discrete finite set. So think about, you know, is this a picture of an airplane or cat or a dog? And then there's a continuous version of that problem. So they're called regression problems. And where these, you know, labels, they can take on continuous values. So think about, you know, finding the line of best fit in your data. Right, so, but for our particular application, we'll just focus on classification. And the three main approaches, generally three, I mean, there are sort of techniques kind of in between these categories, but generally there are three. So there's a supervised setting where, you know, you're given training examples, so your computer can learn from previous examples, you know, unsupervised, where you have no training examples, and reinforcement learning. So this is, you know, a newer type of learning. So we have an interaction with the environment. But for our case, we just look at the supervised for simplicity. And here I just try and explain pictorially how we do this learning and, you know, how we do this testing. So here, let's say we want to distinguish between pictures of ants and cicadas. So each picture can be represented by a vector in multidimensional space. So something we can we call feature space. For example, if we assign each pixel in our picture with one dimension, and the length along this dimension, for example, can be the color of the pixel. So then, you know, each unique picture has its own unique vector. Right? So, and what's important about those training examples that they're your given labels, because you know, okay, that these are pictures of ants. So we have labeled pictures of ants and also labeled pictures of cicadas. Okay, and part of the learning part is to find some kind of separation between these groups of data. So for example, if you assume a straight line to separate them, then you want, you know, a line that somehow maximally separates the data. So for example, you know, this line doesn't work you know, as well as this line. Okay? But it doesn't have to be a straight line. You can use a different learning model. So in this case, you can have a curly line. So it can be some polynomial of a particular degree. But generally, you can use a straight line. So after you've decided on your line and where it is, the testing process comes in, right? So meaning that if we have a new data point, the question becomes, you know, is this new data point a picture of an ant or a cicada? And you're asking, does it lie to the left or right of this line? So this is, you know, a particular pictorial example, but we can think about, you know, these class of problems more generally. So we can design circuits to perform these training and testing procedures. And we can assume that for now that the classifier is some kind of black box. So we feed in the input state, you know, it can be a picture of a cicada, and the outputs are true probabilities. So the probability that the picture is an ant and the probability that it's a cicada. And different machine learning algorithms are essentially different ways of realizing this black box, right? And there are lots of different models available. So for example, you know, one way of realizing this black box could be, you know, something called a neural network. And here, just think about just this black box with a lot of tunable parameters. And we want to choose suitable parameters so that we can best distinguish, you know, between ants and cicadas in a similar way to how we could, you know, have freely moved the position of our straight dividing line until we get some optimal, you know, separation line. But except here, we generally have many more tunable parameters. Okay. And then you can have quantum versions of this. So whether input can be quantum or classical, or the black box, the quantum circuit to realize the classifier itself can also be quantum. Right. So we have examples of you know, a quantum circuit for binary classification, where we measure a single qubit in the end. And here we have the probability of two measurement outcomes if we measure a single qubit. And this can correspond to the probability of you either being, you know, an ant or a cicada. Right? So the exact details are really not so important so far, but the general picture I want you to have is just, it's just some black box, right? And then we have some circuit to represent this black box. Okay, so now in these adversarial settings, you know, how can we start attacking these algorithms? Again, there are lots of possibilities, right? Because the basic process in machine learning we can think about as the following. So we start off with some raw data, you know, and either we can feed our raw data into our classifier, you know, directly, or we can, you know, first extract some features and do some data processing. Then we can assign our learning algorithm. Then we assign the model and train our algorithm. And then at the end, it's the testing procedure. So this is our prediction, you know, whether or not our new picture is an ant or a cicada. But of course, attacks from adversary can come really at any stage, you know, in this machine learning framework. And the attacks can either be quantum or classical, and each point in this procedure, it can actually be quantum or classical. So you already see, just from a combinatoric point of view, you know, how many possibilities there are. And also, you know, the attacks can come, you know, either during training time, right? So, you know, the point where you decide where this dividing line is, or during testing time. So once you've decided, and then you have a new example, you decide if it's to the left or right of that line. But for the purpose of this talk, we'll actually be focusing on just a type of testing time attack. And I'll describe the problem a little bit later. But first, in general, we like to know what are the classes of all possible problems you can have. And we can really, you know, separate these class of attacks into three categories. So first is the adversary's timing. Secondly, the amount of information that is accessible to the adversary. And thirdly, the goal of the adversary. So for the timing, type before we mentioned, it can either be during the training time, so this is also called a poisoning attack, or during the testing time, so often called an evasion attack. But also depends on the amount of information you know about the classifier. So we saw, if it's completely black box, it means we really know nothing about it. We only really know, we might only know what's at the input and at the output. It could be something called a white box, so we know exactly what makes up this classifier, or it can be a gray box, somewhere in between. And there are three types of goals that the attacker might have in mind. So the adversary can either want to deliberately induce a specific type of misclassification, so this is a targeted attack, or they might want to reduce the reliability of the algorithm, or simply they just want to extract information about the classifier. So this is more like an eavesdropping type of attack that we're more familiar with in cryptography. And now I want to get to a very important problem in these type of attacks, and this is called adversarial examples, and this is a testing time attack. When we have the following example. So neural networks or classifiers are known to be, very, very good at image classification. However, it's been discovered to have quite an important Achilles heel. So here it's actually possible to engineer specific perturbations that induce a misclassification. So if we look at this picture of a panda on the left, so for neural classifier, this is like an easy problem, right? And it generally does it quite well. But if you add in, noise, in quotation marks, because, it's something that looks, might look like random noise, but it's not. It's specifically designed a perturbation so that you end up with a picture that looks, exactly the same, more or less, but now it's been misclassified as a given, right, with quite high confidence. And here, this is called a white box attack because the adversary knows something about the classifier, so it can maneuver the perturbation in this specific way. But it doesn't have to be a white box attack. This actually also works for black box attacks. So if we look at the images on the top, so these are the original pictures, and we have the original classifications on the bottom, and we see these are, correct classifications. But then we have adversarially perturbed images on the bottom, which, to us, visually look the same, more or less, but then they're completely misclassified. And in fact, there are also, attacks called single pixel attacks, where you're just changing, one pixel and you completely misclassified your pictures. But in fact, this is not just an anomaly that, only occurs for specific types of data or specific type of models. This is actually a very generic behavior that has been found, across classification models and data sets. As a generic feature of neural networks. And it's not even just for images, for audio data, you also have this problem, so this on the bottom, we have a how are you, with a bit of perturbations, and then it suddenly opened the door, right? And what about in the quantum setting? So there are also quantum machine learning algorithms for classification where, we might want to classify different types of quantum data, is a quantum state entangled or not? Are we in a quantum phase transition? And so does this mean we can also have, quantum adversarial examples? So now we finally get to these questions of adversarial quantum learning. So, and we can consider security vulnerabilities of, quantum machine learning algorithms themselves, or we can think about, what are the quantum machine learning algorithms that we can use to enhance security in the same way that classical machine learning algorithms have been used in that capacity. So we had some of these lovely guys in Barcelona. So Gael and John Ramon and others, they came up first with these quantum change point problems. So you have a classic, you have a quantum state preparation device that, outputs quantum states, steadily, identical quantum states. And at some point it decides to change a state preparation. Okay. And the task is to identify at what point this state preparation device has changed its settings. A little bit later on, there were works that try and, combine, ideas from differential privacy. So this is something I'll describe a little bit later with quantum computation. So not for learning problems, but for, quantum algorithms more generally, right? How we can define these ideas of privacy. And then, thirdly, there are quantum machine learning algorithms for anomaly detection. So detecting unusual features in data. But then, you know, on the other side, we also have the vulnerability of quantum machine learning algorithms. So as far as I know, so this work by Nathan Weeb and Ram Kumar, so they were looking at particular algorithms like, you know, principal component analysis and k-means clustering, and finding more robust versions of these. Okay, so I think Nathan's actually talking here next week. And my collaborator, Dong Ling and Qinghua, so he's been looking at quantum adversarial examples in machine learning, different phases of matter, and also for image recognition. Okay, so, but for a lot of these works, you know, they're, you know, when you look at the vulnerability, the security vulnerabilities of these algorithms, they're quite specific. You know, it's more like, you know, you choose a particular algorithm and you're trying to find more robust versions of that particular algorithm. And this is a trend that was quite prevalent in machine learning, where, you know, this week someone, you know, came up with a more robust version of a particular machine learning algorithm, and the following week someone came up with, you know, a counterattacks. Okay, so it's a bit of a cat and mouse type of game. So then our question is, you know, can we step back a little bit and ask, you know, are there general bounds that we can find for these problems on adversarial examples, and not just these particular types of algorithms and scenarios? And then, you know, maybe that would, you know, lend more insight perhaps on the differences between classical and quantum. And then this leads to two basic questions. Like, firstly, can we say something about the robustness of general quantum classifiers against these type of adversaries? And secondly, you know, once we know these, are there any ways of improving this robustness in a more general way or a more natural way? And by more natural, more general, meaning there are techniques which we can readily use, and also without resorting to particular details about the learning models. Because what we don't want is to think of, you know, a completely different method for every different machine learning algorithm. Okay, so for today's, you know, adversarial learning setup, you know, we have the simplest type of, you know, network, right? So we just have two parties, you know, Alice and Bob. And for this, you know, adversarial example setting, we have, you know, Alice who's the one performing the algorithm. Okay, so you think about, you know, maybe she has access to a quantum device performing classification. And Bob is the one sending Alice test examples. So these, you know, maybe new pictures that, you know, he wants Alice to classify. And the problem is, you know, what happens when, you know, Bob doesn't behave as expected, or there is some, you know, evil Eve who comes in and, you know, adversarially perturbs Bob's example. Okay. So now we're up to the second part of the talk. We'll actually talk about, you know, in this particular scenario, you know, we address the two questions. You know, what is the robustness of a quantum classifier against, you know, adversaries to Bob's test examples? And secondly, can we improve this robustness in a natural way? And we'll show how, you know, noise can help us do that. Right. Do we have any questions, by the way, before I go on to the second part? Any quick questions? No? Okay. So for the first part, you know, what is the general robustness of quantum classifiers against adversaries? So I'll try and motivate this pictorially first. So we saw, you know, this particular example already, you know, telling difference between ants and cicadas, and we have some dividing line. And then this orange point here is some, you know, new testing example. Right? And we see that it's, you know, slightly to the right of this line. So if you're an adversary, what would you do? Okay, so what you would do is you would, you know, push it slightly, you know, across this dividing line. But of course, if you were really, really far, if the original example is really far from the dividing line, you know, it doesn't matter which direction you push, you're never going to, you know, induce a misclassification. So then this gives us an idea. Actually, you know, your ability to find adversarial example, meaning, you know, small perturbation that induces a misclassification, it really depends on the concentration of points that you have near these decision boundaries. So if you're very, very close, then, you know, generally you can always find an adversarial example, but whereas, you know, you're not likely to if you're further away. So here is an example. Like, suppose that we want to classify the points, you know, on the surface of this ball. And for, you know, machine learning algorithms, there's always some, you know, set of points which, you know, originally, you know, misclassified, right? So this is not the same as empirical error. This is just the original probability of misclassification is always there because the classifier is never perfect. Okay. So, and here we just call this class our M. And mu of M, we say this is a probability of you misclassifying. And here, you know, I just drew it as, you know, a single green blob. But in general, you know, it's really dotted, you know, throughout the space of states that you want to classify. And now we want to introduce this concept of epsilon adversaries. So suppose we want to classify this red point here. So if you're an adversary, in order to induce a misclassification, you need to push this red point, you know, towards this green point. And here, you just need to move by the amount epsilon. Okay, so in this case, this will be called an epsilon adversary. And this epsilon is the closest distance between your test data point and your set of misclassified states. And now this, you know, this picture gives us a hint on how we approach our problem. Because now we want to ask, you know, how does this epsilon then depend on the geometry and, you know, dimension of the set of data that we want to classify? All right, so, you know, because this epsilon is essentially, you know, the size of the adversary. Okay. And here, you know, we have access to this mathematical notion of concentration functions. So before we talk about the concentration function, we first define something called an epsilon expansion of M. So here with this green blob, this is the original set of misclassified points. And now for each point on the boundary of this green cloud, we push outwards by the amount epsilon, right? So, and this is called the epsilon expansion of M. And essentially the question about, you know, adversary we want to ask is, what is the probability that the state that you want to classify lies within this epsilon expansion? Because if you lie within this epsilon expansion, then it's always possible for an adversary to move by an amount, you know, less or equal to epsilon before you induce a misclassification. Okay. So now this becomes really a geometrical problem. You know, what is the size of this, you know, epsilon expansion? And this is where the, you know, concentration function helps us. So if the geometry that you're looking at, you know, belongs to these Levy families, then the concentration function, you know, has this form on the right here. So y minus alpha, that represents the probability that you actually land inside this epsilon, you know, expansion region. And if the space belonged to these Levy families, and here D is the dimension, so we notice as dimension increases, then this 1 minus alpha factor becomes 1 very, very quickly, meaning that if the geometry belonged to these Levy families, as dimension increases, you're almost always going to find yourself within this epsilon band. And it so happens that SUD, so this special unitary group of D dimensions, it belongs to these class of geometries. And already you see, okay, well, you know, we can really represent the classes of, you know, pure quantum states, you know, as belonging to SUD. And if we were randomly selecting, you know, from this space, then in high dimensions, we expect, you know, we're likely to fall within this epsilon band and therefore, you know, having an adversarial example. Or a quantum adversarial example. So then we have our first theorem where we say, well, suppose sigma is some d-dimensional pure quantum state. So essentially think about this as selecting from SUD, and a perturbation, you know, sigma to rho occurs, right? And assume, you know, some distance, so the Hilbert-Schmidt distance between sigma and rho is below some epsilon. Now, if the adversarial risk is less than R, so adversarial risk is the amount of misclassification you're willing to tolerate, then the epsilon is less than this factor on the right. So I only want you guys to concentrate on one factor at a time. So here we just concentrate on the factor with dimension. Okay. So this is really saying that as dimension increases, this epsilon becomes, you know, smaller and smaller and smaller. Meaning as dimension increases, the amount that an adversary needs to perturb your original state, it can be smaller and smaller. Before induces a misclassification. So it's much easier to induce a misclassification in high dimensions. Okay. And just on a note here, that this doesn't extend directly to CV states. So because there are only generally a finite number of parameters describing, you know, general CV states. So it's not like as, you know, dimension goes to infinity, this likewise means they're somehow much more vulnerable to adversaries. So that's not the case. And the second part, so this is something I won't talk so much about, but I just want to make a note in case people have questions later. And this factor on the right, this is kind of a trade-off between, you know, the risk which is the amount of misclassification you're willing to tolerate with mu of m. So this is somehow your original external classification. And this is related to a particular form of the no-free lunch theorem in machine learning. Okay, so now what is our quantum setup? So we have our Alice and Bob setup where Alice has access to her whole device, but the inputs that she has comes from Bob, right? And therefore Bob, or some evil Eve who's controlling Bob's state, has the capacity to change the state from sigma to rho. And supposing we wanted to perform a machine learning algorithm, the quantum device for classical states. So meaning that, Bob is really doing the state preparation, is really doing the quantum state preparation for some classical states. Okay. And then, some adversary is now changing the sigma to rho. So then we have, sort of a second result, which is the verification theorem for adversarial quantum learning. So if Alice wants to test if a perturbation in the state has occurred or not, she needs to perform some certification test on sigma. If she wants to perform a certification test with some failure probability beta, then she needs to know how many copies of rho she requires. And here we see, so the only thing I want, the factors I want you to notice is this d to the 4 on the top. Okay, so we happen to know that for certification problems, that unlike state tomography, we actually don't need an exponential amount of resources, like an order log D is enough. And here, yet we still get a polynomial dependence on dimension, right? So somehow this is worse than this is just as bad as tomography somehow. And why is that? Well, because for most of these certification protocols, you actually assume that the error to which you need to certify the state doesn't change. So if you need to know the state of some error eta, then this is something that's constant. However, what's special about these adversarial examples is that because we saw how the epsilon becomes smaller and smaller as dimension increases, and therefore the amount of precision that we want for these states or to certify these states for as we go to higher dimensions, that increases. So this is how we actually get these D factors here. And so this is actually suggesting there is a certain tension now that develops between the resources required to ensure this robustness against misclassification, so this particular method of certification, and there are quantum advantages expected as dimension grows, because a lot of these quantum machine learning algorithms, they're claiming these speed advantages with respect to the size of the data, how high this dimension D is. Okay, so then you're saying, if this is tension developing, is it really worth doing, right? Because somehow even if you have exponential quantum advantage with respect to dimension, you have to pay it back now with doing certification. However, it's not all that bad, because here, even though this is a very general robustness result, it's not all that bad, because we actually assumed that we were selecting our states HA randomly from SUD, right? Because we had this purely geometrical picture, and I'm just saying, like, if our state is randomly selected from SUD, then we can use these concentration theorem results. But in reality, that's not actually what happens. I mean, for any classification problem, you're very rarely just randomly selecting. You're always, selecting with respect to some, prior probability distribution. Albeit maybe probability distributions you don't have a good description of, but it's always some restricted probability distribution. So here, we try and see what happens when we, restrict this HA random selection assumption. So instead of selecting, everywhere, in this SUD, so this sphere is supposed to represent SUD, what if we only selected some fraction, k of the states within this SUD, so these, yellow blobs over here. And then, so the sigma states, they're kind of randomly selected from, these fraction of states in SUD. And then we will have more generalized theorem for adversarial quantum learning. So all the other statements remain the same. So suppose we're selecting, sigma as a d-dimensional pure state from a fraction k of all, possible d-dimensional pure states. And in that case, we actually see there is, you know, every other expression remains the same, even the dimensional dependence. But now we have the fraction k here on the right here, right? So before k is equal to 1, but now we have r over k. And what are the implications for that? So the implications are that if we, you know, choose k to depend on dimension in some way, okay, so for example, here if, you know, k is proportional to 1 over 1 minus e to the power of minus d, then actually, you know, this would cancel the entire dimensional dependence that we have in this robustness expression, right? So, and what this means is that, you know, as dimension increases, as we have, you know, smaller and smaller fractional states that we're looking at, then we actually have better and better a dependence on dimensionality, meaning we become less vulnerable to adversaries in high dimensions if we're really looking at, you know, a more restricted set of states. So an example, if we're only looking at, say, you know, low entanglement quantum states, you know, as we would do in a lot of, you know, natural quantum problems, then we're not looking at the entire SUD, but, you know, a very small fraction of SUD. So, and here, this is something I would like to kind of think more about, but at the moment, you know, it's kind of hinting, you know, if there is really a fundamental trade-off now between our security advantages and knowledge about the state, because as you're restricting your the type of possible states, you're actually given more knowledge about the states that you have. And this is somehow trading off with the adversarial vulnerability. Okay, so now we get to the second question. So now we actually saw what the robustness band is. So can we improve this robustness in any way? Okay, so here we actually see, well, or the claim is that we can actually make these quantum classification algorithms more robust by adding in noise. So this is something that's done with some of these ETS guys. So Minxuan and Yuxuan is one of Minxuan's students. Who came to visit me in Shanghai for an extended period. I think he's still here. and then Dachen and Tong Liang, they're both at the University of Sydney. So these are the classical computer scientists. So we make sure that we want to do the classical parts properly. And the general sort of flow of these arguments goes as the following. So we're saying that noise somehow provides randomization. And randomization gives rise to a property called differential privacy. This is something I'll go into a little bit later. And then differential privacy then gives rise to robustness. So, and the key results that we have that I'll talk about is what we find is that depolarization noise in quantum classification algorithms that can actually help to protect the privacy of the inputs to a quantum classification algorithm. And then the protection of privacy actually helps with taming this adversarial behavior. And then through that, you know, proposing, you know, a new figure of merit for quantum advantage in quantum machine learning algorithms. So, you know, the first motivation is trying to get away from this, you know, speed up centric way of thinking about quantum advantage. So can we, you know, think about a security advantage, like in this case? All right, so first let me talk about this concept of differential privacy, like firstly in the classical case. So before we look at this equation, I'll just try and explain in words, you know, what this privacy concept means. So there are a lot of different concepts of privacy, and this differential privacy is only one particular definition of what we mean by privacy. So and this naturally occurs in distributed settings. So suppose you know, we have some, you know, central server, say, you know, government who wants to collect data, you know, from the population. You know, it can be average height or, you know, some more sensitive medical data. And they're performing, and they want to perform an algorithm in such a way that, you know, the citizens are willing to send in their data so the government can, you know, get all the data that they want, but without exposing the details of individual data, right? So, and one way of achieving that is to say that the net result of an algorithm that the government performs on, you know, the data set is actually not so dependent on the individual data. So that if someone decides to not send their data in, right, then this is not going to make a big difference to the net result. And in this way, you're preserving the individual's privacy. So now just going to a little bit more mathematically. So if we have a randomized algorithm, so this is like the government performing the algorithm and taking the inputs from some data set, and that's represented by a vector X. Okay. And now, they have some, a set of possible outputs. So, and they can belong to some, set S. But now someone decides not to send in their data. Right. So then the net input data set is now represented by X prime. And we want to say that the probability of getting the outputs, of getting possible outputs from if we had input X compared to X prime, that they don't differ by very much. Okay, so here this not very much is quantified by e to the power of epsilon, where epsilon is very small. So, as we see, if epsilon approaches, zero, then, they're identical. So it doesn't matter at all if someone doesn't send in their data. But in general, this epsilon is, a positive but small quantity. And already you can, this should, sound familiar from, when we talk about adversarial examples. Because here we're saying, look, it doesn't matter so much if someone doesn't send in their data. And somehow if one person doesn't send in their data from a very large number of people, that's saying you're really changing your entire data set by a small amount. Okay. And this should remind you of adversarial examples, because you're saying, we have some initial state, we're perturbing by a little bit, and somehow, if it doesn't matter to the end result, then we don't induce misclassification. But if we do induce misclassification, then it certainly means we don't have this, differential privacy notion. So already here we see, a connection between this notion of differential privacy and protection against adversaries. And we can also have quantum versions of these, right? So in the quantum version of these, we're saying we have, our original state, our sigma, and say, it's perturbed, very slightly into a state rho. And now, the special thing about, quantum algorithms is that we don't need to, randomize it, artificially. It's, automatically randomized, because, you automatically have probabilistic outputs. So if, a quantum computer is represented by some quantum operation epsilon, then we have a very similar expression to what we have to the classical definition of differential privacy. So on the left, we have the probability where the output of our quantum device, belongs to some set, SQ. And then if we perturb it, if we perturb sigma by a little bit, then we get rho. And we want to say that the probabilistic outputs, or probability distributions representing the outputs, they only differ by some small amount represented by e to the power of epsilon, where epsilon is very small. And by very small perturbation of the states, we're saying that the trace distance between sigma and rho, they're upper bounded by some quantity tau d. Okay, so, and here we see how, we don't need to add in randomization to our existing algorithm to make, this differentially, private our definition. Because for the quantum setting, somehow naturally fits into this because it's naturally probabilistic. So then there's a lemma that that one can prove, where if we have a general quantum circuit, so this is our state sigma, so this is a state that we might want to classify, and then we have our some ancilla state. So you can have it there, or you don't need to have it there, but this is just very general, and with some quantum operation, or A, and then we're making some measurement output at the end. Okay, so for a classification problem, so if for binary classification, this would be like a single qubit measurement, but for higher orders of classification, then you might want to measure more qubits. But what we'll do is that we actually put a depolarization channel somewhere in our circuit. Okay, and now we want to ask, can we say that this type of circuit satisfies this differentially private definition, and if it does, in what way it depends on the amount of depolarization noise that we put in, because we saw in the definition of differential privacy that somehow randomization might be something that actually improves your epsilon, but of course in the classical case you actually need to artificially inject these type of noises. In the quantum case, you automatically get this, but maybe we can enhance this by adding in even more noise. And indeed, what we see is that the epsilon, so this is, again, quantifying how differentially private you are. So the smaller the epsilon, the more differentially private. It depends on the quantity on the right. So D measure, so this you can think about as the dimension of the final state that you want to measure. So for binary classification, so ant or cicada, any two possibilities, then D is equal to 2. So and this will be like fixed for your classification problem. RP is the amount of depolarization noise. So depolarization noise is just a sum of a certain probability 1 minus p that you do nothing, and then probability p that you actually become a maximally mixed state. Okay, so larger the p, the more the more depolarization noise you have, and then tau d is now the upper bound to the trace distance between sigma and mu. And here what we notice is that, as our P starts to increase, then we actually have, a lower epsilon. So indeed, we do get, more differential privacy as we, suspected with more noise. And it's not even dependent on where we put the depolarization noise. So we could put it at the end, we could put it at the beginning, and we can put it, anywhere kind of in between as well. Okay. And this, expression, it still holds. And for example, this circuit, it can be these, quantum neural network classifiers that we introduced at the beginning. But it's sufficient for us to think about these as a black box. We actually don't need to know any more details about these. Okay, but then it's actually not enough to say you have more differential privacy, right? Because, of course, if we go to the extreme limit of a maximally mixed state, right, then of course we get complete privacy because, everything is, completely random. But then that's also not helpful. So, while you get differential privacy, you also, get a useless classifier. So what we want to make sure is that we have a classifier which is both useful and has differential privacy. And this is what's important about, this lemma, which says that if we actually add in the depolarization channel, then in the case of, infinite sampling, the predicted class label doesn't change. So for a binary classification setting, if your original picture was an ant and it's been classified as an ant, it doesn't matter how much depolarization noise you put. I mean, so long as you don't you don't make it completely mixed, it doesn't matter, how much depolarization noise you put in. So long as you sample infinite number of times at the end, then it doesn't change your class, it's still an ant. But of course, in real life, we only have finite sampling. So then what is the sample complexity to make sure that we're still within the same class to probability beta? The sampling complexity scales as the following. So it scales as 1 over y minus p squared. And what's nice about this is that it's now completely independent of the details of your input state. Like it doesn't depend on its dimension. Okay, it only depends on how much noise you put in. Right. So this is quite a nice scaling. And this is then very good news because it's saying that for classification problems with depolarization noise, so long as you sample enough times, but only with respect to the amount of noise, not with respect to the size of the data, you can always get the same class label that you have. So it doesn't disturb the accuracy. It doesn't disturb the result of your classifier. Okay, so now we see, we get both our the accuracy of our classifier as well as our differential privacy. So now we get both of these things that we wanted. And again, for this theorem, it actually doesn't matter where we put this depolarization noise, right? We can put it at the end or at the beginning or anywhere kind of dotted in between. So with this, we actually get our theorem. So the theorem says the following. So suppose we have a K-class classification problem. So for binary classification, that's K equals to 2. And the output of that, again, the probabilities that we associate with the state being a particular class. So suppose the class label of sigma is 0. And then if we make an assumption about the classes of states that we're looking at. So again, so here, this is not an SUD, hard random selection of states. We're actually assuming that we're looking at states where if it were the right classification, then we need to be quite sure of that. And the amount of quite sure is represented by, e to the power 2 epsilon. So I'll just say it in words in particular example. So supposing, for your states, sigma, it can be like an ant picture, and it has, if we put it in our classifier, then the classifier outputs, the ant with a probability like 70%. Okay. And therefore a cicada with 30%. So therefore the separation between Y0 and the maximum of, you know, Yj, that's, you know, 0.7, you know, is larger than, you know, 0.3. And this difference, this ratio, the difference between 0.7 and 0.3, that's represented by e to the power 2 epsilon. Okay. And so long as we ensure this type of condition, we know that our classifier has this epsilon differential privacy property, right? Because we added in our noise, then you can ensure the classifier is robust against adversaries, where the distance, the trace distance between sigma and rho is upper bounded by tau d. So, you know, in like the general message is that, you know, if we have a noisy quantum circuit, which, you know, gives us a differential privacy, and we add in a little bit of an extra condition, and this is enough to prove a robustness against adversaries. And so what is this extra condition? So this is something that takes us away from the SUD hard random condition. And more precisely, it's the separation between, you know, the probability of you getting this correct class and the next highest probability. And here we have some simulations. So Yushen did these nice simulations on, so we used a quantum neural network classifier with an iris data set just to like demonstrate some of these adversarial settings. So I'll just explain the little graph on the bottom. So in on the x-axis, we have the amount of depolarization. So this is the amount of depolarization noise that we inputted. And the purple line is the amount of robustness. Okay, so here we see that, you know, as depolarization noise increases, we actually get, you know, quite a marked increase in robustness. And this line on the bottom here, these straight lines going down, this is the test score. So this is the, we can think about the probability that we assign that we actually get to the correct class. So, and here this is for a set number of samples that we take. So if we don't change the number of samples that we take as we change the polarization noise, then we see the test score actually goes down. But of course it always starts above 0.5 because again, you know, our theorem says in the infinite sampling limit, it doesn't change your classification. But we can easily make this a straight line. So we're actually not changing the accuracy of the classifier, even as we increase noise, by simply increasing sample complexity. And we actually saw, you know, what sample complexity we need for that. Okay, so now comes the question, okay, so now all these are quantum results. So how does it compare with classical results, right? And, you know, what advantages might it have compared to classical? So here, let's just look at a particular example of, you know, a noisy classical device, right, where we use the same kind of mechanism. So here, suppose, so for you guys who know about this, so, you know, suppose the a classifier is, you know, kernel classifier, and this is something we call a polynomial kernel, but otherwise don't worry about it. So when for the polynomial kernel, just means that, you know, for the low n, where n equals to one, we're using a straight line, dividing line. But for higher n, then, you know, the dividing line becomes more wriggly, right? So that's all you need to know. And here, in order to induce differential privacy, you know, one of the main mechanisms is to use something called Laplacian noise. And we want to know, you know, how much the classifier is robust, you know, against these adversaries for these different ends. Okay. And our theorem, so there's a lot of detail here, but the only thing I want you to notice is that, so L2, this is the L2 norm band for the robustness, you know, if we changed the classical state, you know, x to x prime. But we see that this L2 is dependent on this 1 over n factor. Right. So, and remember this one over n, this tells us, you know, how wriggly the line, the separation line is that we want to separate our data with. So this is really saying that, you know, robustness, but actually it's not just this example, but in general, actually, the robustness results depends on model parameters, right, that you decide. So in this particular example, like n. So this is just to illustrate a particular example, but this is true in general, that it would depend on these parameters. But for the quantum case, we actually see that we lose any of these dependents altogether. Okay, so tau d is now the trace distance between, you know, sigma and rho. So this is the quantum version of like this L2. norm bound. And here we see on the right, so B is just some constant, but P is the amount of noise. And here we see that there's no dependence whatsoever on the, like anything to do with the model. So, and again, anything to do with the model that will be encoded in, you know, the unitary or the quantum operation that makes up this quantum classifier, that to us is a black box, but here it depends on no details about this black box. And we can always now compare that to the classical setting by choosing particular encodings. So for example, if you happen to choose amplitude encoding, so this is encoding your classical data into a quantum state, like in this particular way, where the, you know, elements, you know, of X are now the probability amplitudes, then, you know, our tau D would then be related to the L2 norm. And we see that, you know, the result still holds, that, you know, for the quantum case, you know, we don't have this dependence on the model parameters, but with the classical ones we do. So where does that actually come from? Because, so here we have a particular example, but it is true in general, if we add in depolarization noise. So here, you know, because we thought about this a lot, because first it was, you know, quite mysterious, but then, you know, after thinking about it a lot, we found out actually it's really quite particular to this depolarization noise, right? Because we actually saw for, you know, both our robustness result and also for the differential privacy result, that actually it didn't really matter where we put in this depolarization noise in our quantum circuit, right? But whereas in the classical version of these differential privacy, it really does, you know, depend on where you actually put in your noise. So somehow the really, you know, it's something, you know, quite special to these depolarization noises. But of course, you know, in this particular analysis, it does. But later on, we actually find, you know, there are some other possibilities. But this is something I won't talk about today. So in general, okay, so we saw, so we started off with this idea, okay, so, you know, noise gives rise to randomization, and, you know, randomization gives rise to this differential privacy property, and this differential privacy property gives rise to robustness. You know, and then, you know, our theorem says, okay, so if you have a noisy quantum circuit plus this extra condition, it gives us robustness against adversaries. But somehow in our theorem here, we, the general picture is that simply we have a noisy quantum circuit. Okay, so, but whether or not it has this differential privacy, you know, it's not very clear that it's, you know, absolutely necessary. Like, you know, is it possible to just jump from the randomization part into robustness? So how important is this quantum differential privacy, and can we have robustness with noise alone? And can we have, you know, quantum robustness advantage from, you know, natural randomization outputs? So this is something that, you know, quantum has sort of an advantage compared to classical in that it's, you know, naturally randomized. So this is a direction of future work. So I was hoping to get this sort of done before talking to you guys today, but this is something that will come at, you know, relatively soon, that we have some results like on that. But these are the more general questions that instead of now going by the root of differential privacy, is it possible to just say noise provides randomization, and now we want to restrict the hard random condition, and then, you know, from there we actually achieve robustness. Okay, so what are the main lessons today from adversarial quantum learning? So I would say the take-home messages are the following. Like, firstly, quantum classifiers, like, you know, classical classifiers, that are vulnerable to these adversaries, and its vulnerability depends on dimension and the distribution also from which we select these states to classify. And secondly, we can see that noise can help in reducing this vulnerability, and, you know, it can be done in a way that is independent of the learning model. And, you know, there are many, you know, questions for future investigation. Okay, so looking more at, you know, this robustness between quantum machine learning, and also, you know, can we, another motivation is, you know, can we use the naturally occurring noise that we already have in quantum circuits? So that was one of the original motivations, that, you know, people are always looking at, you know, ways of, you know, getting rid of this noise in quantum devices, but, you know, are we able to utilize some of the existing noise for good, right? So for robustness in this case, and also looking at the connections between, you know, adversaries and random perturbations, because, you know, in both the classical and quantum literature, you know, so far somehow they're seen as very separate things, you know, the security aspect, you know, worst case scenario with noise, but actually, you know, by looking at this, we can actually see more of a continuum between, you know, adversarial perturbations and random perturbations. And again, so thank you so much to Chris for inviting me to these fantastic series. I mean, I only wish I could actually join you guys physically over there. And many thanks to my awesome collaborators, and in particular in UTS, so some interns in UTS and Yushan's PhD students. And here, these are the papers that I've been talking about today. Right, cool. Thanks, guys. So questions? That's very cute.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you very much, Nana, for that talk. Are there any questions from the audience?
I think I can probably read the chat. Hi,
this is Nishti. I just have a question of the misclassified data points. And you expand it by an epsilon, and then you try to find the point which is trying to be misclassified or try to be classified within the boundary of the epsilon. So have you ever given a thought of taking the misclassified data set as a rotating to the misclassified data points by using a QAOA algorithm, and then measuring each point distance with an epsilon so that you can find whether the new point that is added is within that boundary or not. Of course, it will be inefficient way of doing, but is that a possibility?
Sorry, Nishikara, I'm not sure I understood your question. So are you saying that so supposing that you find that you have an adversary, is a way of actually, undoing the work of the adversary using some quantum algorithm. Yeah. Is that the idea? Is that the basic the question? I would say really depends. So for example, if you have access to this new state, but you have enough copies so that you're able to characterize the state, then you know exactly what the adversarial state is. And in that kind of case, it's okay. So if you knew, like, firstly what your original state is, right, and you have the characterization for the final state, then of course you can always move it back. But
my question is particularly to using QAOA on the misclassified points, and then trying to find the adversaries using that QAOA and the epsilon difference.
Sorry, I'm not sure what the significance of QAOA is in here.
You basically put as a put all the misclassified point as a for edges or vertices in a QAOA, and then you rotate as it through to the data points, and you find the differences whether it lies within the boundary of that epsilon.
So maybe you're trying to ask that. Let me just try and guess what you're asking, because I'm still not very clear if this is what you're trying to ask. You're trying to ask if you want to find a different classifier, such that that you want to classify if an example is an adversarial example or not. Right, and you want to use QAOA for is that what you're asking? Yeah. Right. So this is like how do you? Yeah. So this was actually something that was looked at. I mean, not the QAOA part, but the question that was looked at in classical machine learning. You know, are adversarial examples somehow inherently different from other kind of perturbations? So if it is inherently different, then you can think about designing algorithms where you look for that type of thing. So for example, we have these like quantum anomaly detection like type of algorithms. So these are like detecting unusual type of features. But like coming from a lot of these classical works, so there's a lot of evidence showing that these are not somehow like very special. Like they just maybe for like some particular classes, there's a particular direction in which you perturb, and then these sets of states that would be they would induce misclassification. So maybe I suspect for if you do find these classification type algorithms using QAOA or any other type, then they might be quite like model dependent. So not like, you know, for general quantum classifiers, like telling the difference between, you know, okay, if you have these aerosol examples or not. But that would be my suspicion.
Thank you very much. Nana, there's a question in the chat. I can just read it aloud for you.
Okay, sorry, I didn't see it.
Question about noise used in machine learning to improve performance out of sample. How would the use of noise in this context work when noise is added to improve classification?
So can I ask who asked this question? Do you mind just...
Sorry. Thanks, Chris. Sorry.
Yeah.
I was on.
Maybe it's easier. Hi.
Yeah, so it was just a... And maybe the answer's obvious, but sometimes in certainly classical ML, one adds noise to improve the performance of your algorithm out of samples on the test set. But you've kind of touched on an answer already, which I suppose was... like if you're, you know, if you want your algorithm to classify the, if you want to improve the performance of your algorithm, mm-hmm, by including noise on, you know, in your training data, for example, whether there's a way to sort of add that noise, but in some way also use noise in the way that you've been talking about without them interfering with each other in some sense. And you sort of touched on that earlier with whether adversarial perturbations can be sort of classified as distinct from other perturbations. So that was what was going through my head. So if you're using noise on purpose in order to improve the performance of the algorithm, the way to use the techniques that you're talking about in your papers to sort of not undo the beneficial impacts of noise that you add in training.
Oh, right. Yeah. So this was the first set of, let me make sure that I understood you correctly. So you're saying, like normally when you add in noise, like even though you might have other benefits, but actually you might be destroying, either the accuracy of the classifier or some, you know, more, beneficial, you know, parts of the classifier, right?
There are cases where you add noise on purpose in order to improve the performance of the algorithm when you.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah. So I was just wondering, like, if you add that noise because you want to improve the performance, and then you're like, but I want to use this technique, and I sort of need to use noise in a different way. Is there a tension there? Yeah.
Oh yeah. So in this particular case with depolarization noise, so we were trying, you know, different specific types of noise. With depolarization noise, you would expect in a quantum setting it to actually make your algorithm worse, right? so that's not the type of noise that's there to improve your algorithm. But so the good thing about that is to say, well, actually, with depolarization noise, you don't decrease the effectiveness of your algorithm, like if you sample enough times. But actually another kind of motivation is that, you either can inject this noise artificially, or actually what we were thinking originally is how do we exploit existing noise, like that's natural, right? Because, in this kind of NISQ era, already have, so much noise. So, with these error mitigation techniques, some of these are quite costly. So is there a way of, trying to minimize the resources for that, by taking advantage of the noise that we have? So that's... But I think that's a good question. I mean, is there quantum noise that actually enhances rather than, just diminishes? Because when we think about, noise in the quantum setting, we're usually thinking about things that deteriorate your algorithm. And so this is something that we're thinking about, but we haven't actually found a type of noise that does that. I mean, unless it's, something that's very engineered and not very natural.
Mm.
Yeah. But yeah. I think that's a very good question. No, that is something that we're thinking about. Yeah. Thanks for that question.
I had a question as well, Nana. I guess more of a comment that you might be able to comment on yourself. So when I see these like channels where you have your algorithm and then the error channel next to it, very reminiscent of like twirling procedures.
Oh yeah.
I'm wondering if, in some sense, you don't even need to really talk about noise at all. If you imagine, like, say, each step of the algorithm is just you know, conjugated by some Clifford, then overall you'll get some twirling up, effective twirling channel. And so the whole thing can be done like without, you know, like perfectly unitary, provided, you know, you inject the randomness at the level of gate choices. Have you thought about that?
Yeah. So I think that's an excellent question. So this is something that we're thinking about. because actually you're right. Like when I first saw it, that really reminded me of twirling as well. So the reason why we didn't include that first is that when I the main motivation here is to use existing noise, right? Rather than saying like we want everything to be unitary and then we like going along that kind of route. But I think later on when we start thinking about different types of noise and maybe more specifically engineer noise maybe to like enhance a performance in some way, then like in that kind of case then we want to think about like adding unitaries like instead and like selecting these random unitaries to do some kind of twirling. But I think that's so this is something that definitely has crossed my mind, but I don't know how to use it yet.
Interesting, because you were saying, well, you know, we have these devices that are already noisy. Can we use that? But also at the same time, I guess people are thinking about doing these randomization procedures like already. So when we have some sort of error corrected device, some large scale device, we'll be doing these randomization procedures to turn any sort of coherent noise into incoherent noise, because those ones are easier to deal with when doing error correction. So in some sense, whether it's there exists noise already or whether it's, we're talking about fault tolerant devices, I think in either case, there'll be some, there'll be some sort of intentional or existent depolarizing noise happening.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I guess like in some sense you can think about depolarization noise like in like within that setting as well, right? So, there's a certain probability of applying, like nothing. And then applying, equally, sigma X, sigma Y, sigma Z gates. Mm. So, yeah. But this is something I'm happy to discuss later, actually, because there's some things that's in the back of my mind, but I'm not sure like exactly how to deploy that, because at the moment we just haven't been needing that right now. But yeah, but you're right, like it's definitely very reminiscent of things you can do with twirling.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much for joining us.